wanted to do with this book was bring back to the non-threatening secular teachings the full menu. It's like people today, they practice yoga as something you do with a yoga mat and yoga clothes without ever even considering that yoga includes an ethical framework of it's called yamas and niyamas, and a profound philosophical worldview. And it's possible, I think, to teach mindfulness that way too, so that it has the full framework and without having to call it something that seems threatening to a lot of people. Although, you know, Buddhism isn't, you know, it doesn't have a creator deity. There's nothing to convert to. You can be a Christian Buddhist, a Jewish Buddhist, an atheist Buddhist, or a Buddhist Buddhist.
This time on the Plutopia News Network, author, poet, translator, and educator Gary Gock joins John and Scoop in our virtual studio. We discuss Gary's latest book, Pause, Breathe, Smile, and much more.
Hey, welcome everybody to the Plutopia podcast. For this particular episode, we're going to be talking to Gary Gock, who is an author, a translator, editor, teacher, and poet. Gary lives in San Francisco. His latest book, which we'll be talking about somewhat, is Pause, Breathe, Smile: Awakening Mindfulness When Meditation Is Not Enough. He's written several other books, including various editions of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Buddhism. And I think that we met around the time that one of those versions was released. He also edited What Book? Buddha Poems from the Beat to Hip Hop, which was a winner of the American Book Award. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here.
I should also tell our listeners, to find us on Twitter at Plutopia. And we do have a Facebook page. So we hope you'll all give us comments, feedback, even questions. We're happy to address. So, Gary, welcome to the Plutopia News Network.
Thank you. It is a great honor and a pleasure indeed.
And we're so happy to have you. I want to roll back the fog from the very beginning and ask you how you started meditating.
Ooh, that goes way back. You mean when I knew I was meditating? Because I think, you know, cats meditate. I think we all were born knowing how to meditate.
Perhaps your history as a meditator.
Yeah.
Early history.
Yeah. So for me, I clearly remember there was a certain day in Los Angeles. I was in school. It was grade school. I was about 8. And the teacher was filling in before the lunch bell with some insidiously stupid thing about raise your right hand, raise your left hand. I just looked at her like, this is dumb. I'm not going to do it. And I looked out the window and I had a mystic vision. Or I had a vision, or it came to me in like a split second that everything's all interconnected is what I saw, to put it into words. And I talk about it in the book, and just to move on, because it's the kind of thing that's like, you know, how do you describe it? How do you explain it? I had this vision, and I went home and I tried telling my mother, but before I opened my mouth, she kind of saw something coming and she said, wait a minute, I'm an atheist. And if you want to talk to me about anything like God, I got to ask you, who invented God? Who made God? And I'm like, oh. So I kept this like a little gold coin that I'd found in that little tiny pocket in the jeans over your larger pocket.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't get mixed in with the coinage of every day. And it was about a year or two later. I was at the corner store. I picked up cigars from my grandfather, and I got a pocketbook for myself. The Way of Zen had just come out in pocketbook. Very attractive cover.
That was what? Arthur Edward White?
No, this is Alan Watts.
Alan Watts. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Alan Watts, who I got to meet later. So I'm reading the book, and page, I don't know, 35, he's explaining what I saw. I think he called it dependent co-arising, which is what they called it in those days, a translation from Sanskrit. Now I'd call it interbeing, just the inner unimpeded interconnection and interpenetration of all things. But, you know, having a book wasn't the same as having a teacher. My parents couldn't really help me. When I was in Hebrew school, we weren't taught about meditation. And yet I find that I'm now resonating with the universe, identifying myself as a Buddhist already. And there are no Buddhist teachers. There's statues behind glass cases in museums, but nobody sitting on cushions talking to other people sitting on cushions about the way it is. And so there's this kind of phase in my life that's kind of parallel with the coming to the West of Buddhist teachers. When I was in LA, I met Paul Reps. I met Paul Reps, who was famous for a book called Zen Telegrams, which is what I had first, how I discovered him. Later, I discovered he did a book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones with
Neil. Yeah, that's the one I was aware of.
Which I had as another pocketbook. And he first taught me just kind of a basic Zen meditation.
Can I interject one thing here?
I don't want to make this the whole show.
No, that's fine. I definitely want to continue with this, but I think it's important to clarify that the kind of experience you're talking about having when you had a moment of insight or awakening or awareness, that it's not the same as thinking it, because people can think about, you can describe that insight in words and a person can think about it in words, but it happens on so many levels. It happens not just in your brain that you're thinking, everything is interdependent, but it's a real strong, like, perception of it, a real feeling of it.
Absolutely.
Is that
right? And
aligned with your experience?
Pardon?
Does that align with your experience?
Absolutely. And, you know, now that you say it and I hear it, I would say the closest I would come to it would be a haiku. You know, where you can't explain it, but when you get a haiku, you find this kinship with the universe in a very intimate, direct, and genuine way that completely goes beyond, you know, intellectually understanding symbolism or anything like that. It's like it's direct, right? So good point. You know, so I couldn't find anybody to model the experience of living this way for me. And being Jewish on my parents' side meant that there really weren't any teachers anymore, because Hitler's campaign was successful pretty much in wiping out the lineage of mystic teachers or Hasidic teachers or Jewish teachers. So I'm identifying as a Buddhist. I move up to San Francisco. The Zen Center formed, and I visited that, you know, kind of with interest, but also kind of standing back a little. One of the teachers from that lineage, Danen Katagiri, taught me Zazen, which I loved, you know, receiving from him. And going back, there was a little blue book. I don't know if anyone remembers. There used to be these nickel and dime mail order small pamphlets that you could get. And I had gotten one on meditation, And I'd been meditating on my breath since I was like 10, but I didn't have a teacher. So anyway, just to answer the question up to date, in the mid-80s, I think it was, a Vietnamese Buddhist teacher came to America for the second time to teach. His name is Thich Nhat Hanh. I went to Berkeley. I'd never read his stuff before. I walked into the Martin Luther King Jr. Auditorium, and before he came on stage, his monastics came out on stage first. And I'm like, huh, this is interesting. He's part of a community. He's building a community. And I like the community. I think we did some singing, which I enjoyed. And then he came out on stage, and just I felt warmth for when he started talking. He's a brilliant teacher. He's intellectually, you know, colossal. But I felt great warmth and heart. And I just, as my community, I felt at home here. So since that point, I have been following this as my root teaching, my root lineage. You know, and I still pick up some Sufi stuff and Qigong and all sorts of other things. But this has been pretty much my main path. And it's got a name, the Village Community of Engaged Buddhism is the kind of long name.
So how do you relate to the, I mean, there's various schools of Buddhism and various traditions, and, you know, you studied with Thich Nhat Hanh. I assume that you've studied elsewhere as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is a good question that I feel very strongly about. This is what a lot of the Complete Idiot's Guide to Buddhism did that I don't think anybody else had done before, which is put the various major schools of practice forward without any particular bias. So people could see, you know, and I had studied or been with Pure Land and Jodo Shinshu, and I met a beautiful Tibetan teacher. Insight meditation was just starting to happen. It's important to point out that there isn't really one size fits all Buddhism off the shelf. It's more of whatever culture and background you come from, where you connect with it.
So let's talk then about your a different history, your history as a writer, how you got into writing and the kinds of things that you've written that are maybe not about Buddhism.
Yeah, well, no, but that was about the same time. The same time that I'd had this kind of me awakening. I wrote my first poem when I was 10. It was called Return Trip. And I started writing haiku around this time. And so I followed the way of poetry for many years. At that period, the beats were you know, captivating the culture, and there was some pockets of beat activity in LA that I connected with. So I was pretty much engaged in poetry for much of my life. I was at UCLA film school, and I knew I wasn't going to be a film person during the Vietnam War. I moved up to San Francisco, and I did a lot of journalism, which helped me very much hone my craft. And I got into the habit of writing about, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 words a day, if I could. I wrote a novel, you know, so I was starting to get interested in writing whatever, you know, was there to be written. My first two books were about the internet. And I was the first, one of the first people in San Francisco to be training people in what is the internet. And after I'd done that file, it got into a format as a pocketbook from Pocket Books on the, you know, supermarket racks. And then someone wanted me to do one for writers. And then I did an anthology of Buddhist poetry, What Book. I translated co-translated three books from Korean of a major poet from Korea who was also a Korean Zen master.
Do you speak Korean?
Pardon?
You speak Korean?
No, I co-translated.
Ah, so somebody translated it and then you made a more conceptual translation?
Well, there's two books that I have yet to publish. It's When I Began Translating and How I Discovered That I Have This Ability. At UCLA, there was a teacher named Jack Hirschman who moved up here. He was the poet laureate here. He was big on translation back in the 50s. So I, you know, considered translation. I'd done French translation, but when I was working in North Beach, I met this Chinese gentleman who invited me to his home to translate Chinese poetry with him because he'd been doing this for about 20 years with another American, European background person, but who had gotten senile and he needed to finish some books that they had started, and I got nominated. And after the, long story short, after the fourth time at his house, he was looking over the stuff that, you know, he'd give me some stuff in Chinese and English, and I'd kind of work up a version. And he's looking at one, and he kind of like, his hair went on fire. I don't know what it was. I said, "What's wrong?" He says, "Nothing's wrong. I'd worked on this poem with this other guy, Vince, we couldn't get that line right, and you did it. What did you do? How did you do it?" And I just kind of stroked my beard and went, "Huh, what did I do?" And I thought about it and I realized I know how to do this. This is a skill that I have, like, you know, some people have perfect pitch. I don't know. So he and I, we translated all the dynasties together. And I got really, you know, awakened to literary translation and doing it in collaboration with a native speaker in a way that sort of, it automatically effaces or erases, you know, my sense of ego and finds myself instead in service of bringing this poem into English, into a life of its own. So I had done the Chinese, and then I got roped into doing this Korean period, which was really fascinating. And now I'm finishing a book of Sufi poems by a contemporary from Iran, which I've also been doing with a native speaker. And then somewhere in there, I did the completed It's Guide to Buddhism, and more recently, this handbook of mindfulness, not so much as a tool, but as a way. And some magazine articles and journalism, and, you know.
You're associated with Tricycle too, right?
No. I mean, I've written for Tricycle more than, no. I've written for Tricycle and Shambhala-san and Buddha Dharma and Yoga Journal. I don't have a real set, you know, place at any of them.
It's very interesting that when you meditate, you're sort of not attaching yourself to words and concepts and that sort of thing. Yet there's so much written about Buddhism and there's so many words and concepts around Buddhism. I always find that kind of interesting, you know, it seems kind of ironic that something that is beyond words has so many words associated with it.
Mm. Yeah.
How many versions of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Buddhism did you write?
Oh, there, it's now in the third edition.
Third edition? And how did you approach that project?
Well, at that time, I didn't find any books that explained, recorded, reported what is Buddhism from a real general point of view. There were books about Zen and books about this and that. And around the time that the, you know, because I'd done this internet book, the Dummies and the Idiot's Guides had started originally as computer books, and they had been branching out into non-computer things like, you know, sex and flying saucers and philosophy and whatnot. And I thought it would be a great match to hook up the teachings of the Buddha in this format, which is very rigorous in terms of how many chapters and how many parts to each chapter, because Buddhism's like that in its original form. And I thought it would be great too to, you know, I'll confess, the one reason I write is to learn. So I thought it'd be great to, you know, have a publisher give me an advance so I could, you know, learn about Buddhism by processing what I knew and I didn't know through language. And it became evident that this would include writing about the different schools, which nobody had done before. And, you know, I found the structure in the material, which is kind of one way I like to work. That is, in Buddhism, the core, really foundational principle or image or idea is this notion of the unity of the people that practice Buddhism, the Buddha or our Buddha nature, and the teachings of the Buddha. I think it's called Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Sometimes it's called the triple gem. And so what I did was I made that the outline of the first part of the book. So it's the teachings of the Buddha. It's the life of the Buddha, the spread of his teachings, the teachings themselves, the different schools of Buddhism. And the second half was applications of Buddhism in various walks of life. So it was like the first half is living Buddhism, and the second half is Buddhist living. And the thing that I'd say about the book in looking back is that I had such little time to do each chapter. It's like it took 2 years to finally get the proposal sold. It was like, hurry up and wait. And then they wanted it yesterday. And so I had to write a chapter a week and find all the art each week. And I didn't have time to sit down and kind of deliberately have a lot of wriggle room. It was like going down a corridor and not turning back until I was done, which is a great experience.
You mentioned that you were influenced by the Beat Poets early on, and that was one of my first interesting and non-Texan experiences, was discovering the Beat Generation. Friend gave me a copy of Gregory Corso's The Happy Birthday of Death. Yes. And a copy of On the Road, and that was quite an experience for a guy that was practicing to be a village idiot in West Texas. How did it influence your writing?
Well, the Beats were like opening a window in a room that hadn't had any oxygen in a way. maybe in retrospect, you could say, well, no, it had its links to English Romantic poetry or Tom Wolfe or whatever. But heck, I had never read anything like these people. For one thing, I think they were reinvesting the power of the word as something holy and spiritual, which is where you get the name Beat, because it's from Beatitudes. And in a very contemporary way, so that it wasn't like a stuffed owl in my grandparents' attic, but something really present and contemporary and vivid and vital. And of course, there was also the anti-establishment aspect of it, which is to say, during a period when, although America was at its peak as a country in the world, everything wasn't all a bed of roses. And the Beats voiced the dissatisfaction people had with, say, the possibility that a nuclear bomb could destroy everything, and the segregated quality of the North and South, the still uptight morality of the Bible Belt. I haven't really, thought reflectively to give anybody an answer to that. It's a very good question. I hope I'm giving a start or a foothold.
Well, the whole Beat generation, it was fascinating to a guy like me out in the middle of nowhere. John and I grew up in the same small town in West Texas, and it was culturally deprived, to say the least. I was a habitual reader. I read every book at the local library, probably. But these were the first books that I read that had dirty words in them, and dirty thoughts, and radical thoughts, and just opened me up to, you mean people are allowed to do this sort of thing in print? And when I finally moved to Berkeley in 1973, of course, the first pilgrimage was to City Lights. I had to go at least buy something there. And that seems to have been a bunch of writers that influenced a whole lot of people, not just writers, but musicians, politicians, or not so much politicians, but politically active people learned a lot from that whole approach to life.
Absolutely. And it was international in a way. There were other similar kinds of artists in other countries. And then, and originally there weren't that many beatniks. You could maybe fit them all in the back of a bar and you'd have most of them in the country. But it spread into my generation. I'm kind of transitional, but I'm 73, but the hippies, took the beat, a lot of the beat ethos, and became more of the counterculture, a national and international movement of great size, proportion, and impact.
Yeah, and it seems like that there was sort of fertile ground at the time as the Beats and the hippies too had been drawn to considerations of what you might call spiritual adventurism, where they, somebody who maybe was raised in some church or synagogue, realizing that there's other ways to think about what might, this be this called the spiritual dimension or transcendence or what, that sort of thing. And Buddhism sort of started to take root in America at just that time.
Exactly. Yeah.
And was nurtured, by the attention of those people who found that as a compelling different path to take.
Yep, yep.
I know I became a Buddhist, I discovered what led me to meditation was that I wrote a letter to Allen Ginsberg and sent him a poem. Huh. And he wrote me a postcard back, and he told me that he liked my poem.
Oh.
But my letter had been full of a lot of, like, adolescent angst. And he said, as far as your Peter Pan yak is concerned, you might try some Dhyana meditation. Oh. And which I looked into that in Zen meditation. And that's when, I took his advice and I started meditating. Wow. But that was a path that he had gone down and that he was finding was fruitful for him and was helping him. We were all looking for ways to expand our consciousness back then. And you could do it with drugs, which was like the shortcut, mm-hmm. but you could also take the long path and some might think a more fulfilling and interesting path of getting to know your own mind.
Yeah. Gee, that's great. And as I'm listening to our talking about this, I got to say, history didn't begin with us. I don't think the Beats came out of nowhere. Besides the an earlier era of Bohemians in the 20s, in poetry, the Beats had predecessors like William Carlos Williams, who was saying, "No ideas, but in things." Wallace Stevens, too, who had been influenced by the East, and we're just beginning to find how they could find ways of bringing it forth in a Western and particularly American culture. Like 18 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird by Wallace Stevens is a familiar example.
Yeah, I think in poetry and also in meditation and mindfulness, you're sort of confronting the constraints of the mind in a way. I mean, I think when you're writing poetry, you're trying to sort of free that stuff up. You're trying to free your head, so to speak. And it seems to align pretty well with the practice of Buddhism and the practice of mindfulness. And there's so many poets who went down that path. Probably pretty notably, Gary Snyder was such a great Buddhist poet.
Yeah, he was like one of the first Americans to go to Japan and to study Zen. And when the monastics in the temple who were just used to doing routine chores saw somebody who was really interested in meditating, that inspired Suzuki Roshi to come to the West and bring Zen Buddhism to America because he felt there was more interest in America than in Japan. So Gary Snyder is just, tremendously fertile bridge going both ways. Actually, the readers at the first big Beat reading, the sixth gallery reading where Ginsberg read Howell, all but one became Buddhists or were Buddhists, Allen Ginsberg, Philip Whalen, Gary Snyder, and so forth.
Who was the one?
Hmm?
Who was the one that didn't?
Oh, Philip Lamantia.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he was a radical Catholic.
Yeah, I realized. Yeah. Realist. So this all leads on a path to your current work, Pause, Breathe, Smile. I know I'm aware that there did that originate with you, that idea of Pause, Breathe, Smile, the sort of conceptual framework there, or did it precede you?
It preceded me. In the book, I acknowledge Joe Yoder, who had made that a slogan of hers. She's a Vietnamese American disciple of Thich Nhat Hanh. But I didn't finally come to her formulation until I think the third or fourth draft. I think I had Stop, Breathe, Smile, and then I realized Pause would be gentler. And then I noticed, no, Joe had already been saying Pause, Breathe, Smile, and I hadn't noticed that before. But it's very common in the community of people who practice in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, I think there's a mindfulness program in the schools in New Zealand that has that.
I actually called them and said, could I use, would they mind if I use that phrase? Because they use it.
Yeah.
It's like one of those, it's like a family, it doesn't seem to, family object, it doesn't seem to belong to anybody. What I did was I kind of invested it in both a possibility of a simple formula that anyone can always practice, like right now, we can pause, we can take a conscious breath, feeling the air in our lungs, we can smile, realizing we're alive. And it's also the outline of the book as a way of teaching Buddhism without having to call it Buddhism. That pausing is the ethical component, breathing is the meditation component, smiling refers to the wisdom, which is, you were saying earlier, John, is kind of ironic that it just goes beyond words.
I'm interested that you said you can teach without I really calling it Buddhism, and I've experienced similar kind of things in the field of religion, of where people of us who have very firmly rooted in a particular religion or belief system really have trouble dealing with another one unless you call it something non-threatening.
Yeah. Well, that's what's happened with mindfulness. In a way, although what I wanted to do with this book was bring back to the non-threatening secular teachings the full menu. It's like people today, they practice yoga something you do with a yoga mat and yoga clothes without ever even considering that yoga includes an ethical framework of, it's called yamas and niyamas, and a profound philosophical worldview. And it's possible, I think, to teach mindfulness that way too, so that it has the full framework and without having to call it something that seems threatening to a lot of people. Although, you know, Buddhism isn't, you know, it doesn't have a creator deity. there's nothing to convert to. You can be a Christian Buddhist, a Jewish Buddhist, an atheist Buddhist, or a Buddhist Buddhist. But that's getting kind of, I don't know, technical.
Yeah, it's non-theistic, not really a religion. I've had debates with people about this. Where I say, you know, Buddhism is not really a religion. And some people believe that when someone has a statue of the Buddha, that they're in a worshipful relationship with that statue. But I think that's generally not the case.
How do you see it?
Well, I think it's not that you're worshiping the Buddha, but that you're inspired by the Buddha.
Yeah, it's a way of instilling that which is within us as a good reminder.
I mean, you know, the phrase like "kill the Buddha." I think the intention is usually to sort of evolve to the point where you don't need the Buddha, to where you have become who you essentially are, and you don't need a prop, I guess, or you don't need a teacher, or you don't need a guide anymore. You're there, you know, you're sort of like completely yourself. But you know, that's That's what I think. What do you think?
Oh, if you see a Buddha on the road, kill him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, in the practice, you want to avoid getting hung up on the forms and, you know, I guess another way that I look at it is, I think you're right. I think you're very right. I see it similarly in another way, too. On a foggy night, we need a finger to point out, where is the moon tonight? But then the game is not to take the finger for the moon. And so we need a Buddha along the way to point to our own awakened nature, to our own birthright of living fully, to our fullest capacity for ourselves and others. And the idea is not to get hung up on something external, you know, like something in a church or on an altar or in a book or any form at all. Because it's beyond form. It's beyond an ideology or image or any of that.
So you see it more as a placeholder, a reminder that you have Buddha in somewhere inside or outside of you.
Exactly.
You are Buddha.
It's the three Buddhas.
There you are.
On the Plutopian News Network.
So, pause, breathe, smile is sort of a practice in itself. I know you have exercises in the book and so forth. Do you want to talk a little bit about how the guidance of the book works for people?
Sure. The book is like three pages, and the three pages are just if we stopped and took three breaths, and the book has got a little guide to what if, you know, you just feel this breath coming in and out, and this is good, taking another one and maybe feeling more of your body, this is good, maybe smiling the next time, and then it says all the rest is commentary. And the commentary are these three parts, pause, breathe, smile, which has a table of contents you can read in any order. I would say now you might want to start with smile and then go to pause and breathe. That is, you start with the view. And the first part of the view is like what we were saying, is you don't have any view. And in the book, I offer the teachings of interconnection and impermanence and non-self as aspects of reality that are good to hang on to as we find our way in reality and the way things are and seeing things directly so that we don't get hung up. We're always, you know, on firm, solid. We are solid. And then you also want to be practicing in an ethical way. It's not enough to say, oh, I'm calm, get out of my way. Or, oh, you stepped on my foot, that's okay, I'm calm. Or, you know, any of the kind of non-relational ways of taking a part of this and just sort of building up your own ego. So the book has the teachings about how to make conscious conduct part of your practice. And in it, there's a teaching called study, observe, practice, which is a Vietnamese Zen practice that I don't think you'll find anywhere else and is like just one of my favorite, most important things that I do. It's a way of studying so that you can use life in your own mind as a mirror in practice, in action. And just as you want to practice your wisdom in action and your ethics in action, the section on meditation is a short capsule guided tour of what's called the full awareness of breathing. The teaching that we don't have to take a full breath or have any particular kind of breath. But if we let go of control of our breath and wanting it to be any particular way and just observing it and being part of it and letting our breath and our mind and our body sort of find each other and become one, the book goes into, you know, some of the depths that you might be able to connect and touch by just practicing conscious breathing. So it's a handbook. It's practical. It has some, a little, you know, philosophy too, but it's all meant to be put, it's how you put it into action.
Do you talk about the ethical framework of Buddhism?
Yeah. When in Asia people learn about Buddhism, they usually learn about the ethics first. Very often they don't get teachings in meditation until later, and sometimes they only just practice the ethics. In Buddhism, they're very similar to ethics we know in the West, such as, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not drink, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not commit adultery. Except in Buddhism, it's not top down and thou shalt not. It's bottom up based on our own lived experience. This is why I say it's like a mind mirror. What we observe in other people, we observe because we're noticing something in ourselves. And in order to live harmoniously with ourselves and others, these basic ethical teachings are important. In my tradition and in the book, I show how they're very open for innovation and interpretation in your own life. Like instead of saying thou shalt not, you can phrase them all positively. Reverence for life, true love, true happiness, deep listening and loving speech, and nourishment. And then it opens up in all kinds of things. Like nourishment can be, are you listening to a nourishing show like the Plutopia News Network? Or are you listening to some kind of a thing that's all about if it bleeds, it leads, or you know, something violent? So living a life in which your conscience is clear and you're feel aligned with the good in life, and connecting with that in others. You know, that's so much, that's like all of the practice right there. In Buddhism, if you practice anything deeply enough, it connects to all the others. So if you connect with the ethics, you're connecting with meditation and you're connecting with wisdom.
You speak about the peaceful ways of Buddhism. There are also Buddhist warriors, the warrior monks of Japan back in medieval feudal Japan. What is the difference there in the two ways of being Buddhist, being a warrior, and being a pacifist?
Huh. Well, that's a very timely question, Scoop.
That's why I ask it. There's a lot of
things. I guess that's what we're all leading up to. I don't know whether you can say whether all Buddhists are pacifists, because there are cases in Buddhist history where someone did something violent in order to bring about something positive, like the monk who immolated himself in the streets of Vietnam. That was not a nonviolent action. And yet it helped change the lives of so many in Vietnam and America. It's also known that he had cancer and he knew he was going to die, but nevertheless, you have these ethical questions in Buddhism of what is the right way? In Japan, you have the tradition of the samurai becoming totally enamored of the way of Zen and wanting it for themselves. They wanted to know this fearlessness that the Zen monks had, and so they endowed the monasteries, and Zen in Japan has this very strong warrior element. But in World War II, it was the Japanese Zen monks who would go to the top circle of the government, sit down and say, this war is wrong. And they were able to do it because they were monks. Otherwise, they'd be killed. So there's a history of both pacifism and also of the warrior class, the samurai. There's, by the way, a book called Zen at War by Brian Victoria, which goes deeply into Japan's karma in this respect of having a warrior culture. The Tibetans were known for being very great warriors. In the United States, I believe, had them in the front lines of some of the troops in Afghanistan. Are they practicing war, or are they practicing a nonviolence in their way of being in the midst of war? The samurai, Zen samurai, has this notion of not killing, and killing is not being separate. I'm just saying. So the warrior, and then I guess I got to say, just to be, because, you know, it's a topic for a whole program, especially now, the karma collectively, if you will, of Burma, Myanmar, had been one where they felt that they had this military regime ruling them for so long because of something that they had done as Buddhists in Sri Lanka, and it was kind of like retribution. But the fact was that up until Aung San Suu Kyi, and then even now, there's been a lot of violence in Myanmar, Burma, committed by Buddhists. So I guess, you know, my personal quick takeaway answer, it's not really an answer, it's just the way I think about it, is that peace is made of non-peace elements. That there isn't a world in which there's no war, and there isn't a world in which it's all peace. It's sort of like the two are marbled together somehow, and if we can convert the investments into destructive, non-beneficial military violence into something that's of benefit, by all means, I think that's a good thing to do. The example there is King Ashoka in India, who, after his bloodiest battle, decided to hang up the sword and converted everything in the country to peacetime uses. And during his reign, the country was never invaded, sort of like Costa Rica, a world without an army. Golly, what a question. What do you think?
I remember covering in my journalist days, covering a demonstration in Berkeley, which we had a large crowd chanting fight for peace. And it just kind of floored me, and I had to actually sit down and gather my thoughts, like, what do they mean?
Were they...
These were, you know, your typical
Berkeley... Were they hawks, or were they doves?
No, these were the peace demonstrations, you know, against the Vietnam War.
Well, Ed Sanders had a song, "Kill for Peace."
Oh, I know. Yeah, it was just the
far or very Middle East.
It was just the
I don't know,
the juxtaposition that it floored me. Of course, I knew what they meant, but yeah. It was just like an automatic thing for the crowd to chant.
So. To just try and unpack this question of war and peace as being intermarbled. As I'm going forth in the world now, very much inspired by my teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who kept the tradition of peace and joy alive during the American War in Vietnam. I think of it this way. If we think of peace as like a bottle of oil with a dropper, and we drop a little drop into a beaker of water. It ain't going to change anything. It's just going to be more and more little blobs of oil in a jar of water until there's one drop and the whole equation changes. And then you have a jar of oil with blobs of water. And so as Buddhist or not, you know, pacifists go forth in this world of war. I don't know whether we can stop war. We can talk to warriors and learn from them, and they can learn from us by our insight into the nature of a war as a manifestation sometimes of greed, fear, or ignorance at a personal and also in on a social or a complex community level. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I think the warrior is often dedicated to peace, but seeing that the only way to achieve peace is through strength, I guess. But
yeah,
the other way I would think about this is I think there are things like competition and anger, and I mean there's various things that it's really about minds being out of sync, really. I mean if people were to, if you had a broad practice of mindfulness, I think that that you would have people whose consciousnesses could align in a different way so that cooperation could be more likely than competition and peace could be more likely than war, you know, and instead of fighting, you know, be like conversing and finding ways to be together and work together.
Yeah, well, if you understand,
but it's a constant struggle, you know, because you can't just make that happen.
Right. If you understand your own mind, you understand your reactivity to want to react to anger with more anger, and through training, mind training, meditation, you learn that it's not an appropriate response, that it's only escalating the situation and trying to put out a fire with gasoline, and that if you can maintain your own strength, you can perhaps through dialogue, as you say, find a more skillful way of resolving difficulties and, you know, ending suffering.
Yeah, skillful means.
Exactly.
And if you have a really deep understanding of your own mind, you come to understand that it's every mind.
Yeah. Yeah, the seeds in our mind of anger and of peace are, well, the Buddha talked about it in terms of something that Jung called a collective unconscious. In Buddhism, it's called alaya vijnaya. Which is this notion that we have a store consciousness that's deeper than our personal individualism. So that when I connect with my own mind, I'm connecting with a garden
that soil, it belongs to everyone. It's a community.
A wave upon the ocean.
And everyone is just like me.
Well, Gary, thank you very much for joining us today.
Golly, it's been a privilege, a pleasure, and a Plutopian delight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. We had to delay it a couple of times, and I'm really happy that we've had a chance to talk, and we hope you'll come back and join us again.
Yeah, I'd love to. Hey, thank you. This has been a long time coming, and it's a great flowering. Thank you so much.
Gary's book, Pause, Breathe, Smile, is available on Amazon.com. Learn more about Gary at levity.com/interbeing. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.